This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? Learn more about Wisconsin's cheese-making history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're ringing in the start of our fifth season with dispatches from Portland, Oregon's biggest food festival, Feast Portland. We're bringing you words of wisdom on launching a food business from food blogs.
Most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit very quickly afterwards.
To ice cream shops.
Every city you go to, the salt and straw is completely different than any other city.
We'll bring you insights and anecdotes about the business of the business.
We were like, cool, we're going to do this. We're going to try to raise $75,000 and we'll see what happens. And it was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm your host, Eli Sussman, and welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Every week, I sit with a new guest, and we trace the trajectory of their life and career. From early childhood to first jobs in food to their current projects, we dig deep into the choices they made, the twists and turns of their career, and the mistakes and successes that they will never forget. Today's guest is John Stage, the owner of Dinosaur Barbecue, with 8 locations across New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. They have a line of rubs and sauces available nationwide, and the cookbook John released in 2001 has sold over 175,000 copies. With over 30 years in the business, John has seen it all. Dinosaur started as a mobile pop-up in 1983 at the Harley Rendezvous in New York, a motorcycle meetup, and in 1988, along with his then-partner, they opened a location on Willow Street in Syracuse, New York, still open today. John back then had tattoos. He's still got them now, but he had long hair, a huge bike, and a love of barbecue, but no professional business experience and very little food experience. Along the way, he's had lots of partners, some that are no longer with the brand and some that are workers that have been converted into owners. As the company rapidly expanded in the early 2000s, they opened up many locations with the Soros partners. Today on the show, we'll talk about how it all began with a 55-gallon drum sawed in half, what partnering with the Soros family did for the business, both positive and negative, how having a consumer package good line can impact a brick-and-mortar restaurant, and maybe John will even clue me into some secrets about motorcycle culture along the way. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eli.
I want to begin at the beginning. Let's talk about your childhood. Where were you born? What did your parents do? And did you grow up in the type of house that could have ever been the trajectory that set you on opening up a barbecue restaurant?
Oh, that's a lot to unpack there. Let's see. I was born in Nyack, West Havistraw. I was born in Nyack Hospital, grew up in West Havistraw, then moved to Long Island, Huntington Station, and then when I was 13 years old, moved to Syracuse, New York.
And so you're in Syracuse. What do your parents do? And what kind of kid are you? Studious, well-behaved, badly behaved?
Let's see. My mother was a secretary. My father worked for the Grand Union Company. They're not around anymore, but he's a produce man for the Grand Union Company. Very bad kid. Very bad kid. Yeah, I got into a lot of trouble when I was a young man.
Some of that trouble ended up getting you into prison.
Yeah.
You found yourself at 18, you were incarcerated, and you ended up working in the prison mess hall.
Yes.
Was that a terrible job? Did it inspire you in any way? Was that the type of job that people were really hoping to get in prison? Tell me about that experience a little bit.
Well, the experience was probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It got me into the kitchen, and I started in the general kitchen. My job was taking 55-pound bag of eggs and mixing them with water, the powdered eggs, and then I'd get up on the line and scoop out the food. So I always got kind of a rush from the action of, 1,500 people coming through a line at one time, and I really enjoyed that. And then I was, I got connected with a few other people, and I got promoted to the officers' mess hall, where now it was a little, the food was a little better because you fed all the cops in there. And I loved it. It was it actually started my career in the food service business.
Did any aspect of that contribute? Did it straighten you out a little bit at all? Did it turn you into the type of person who you were starting to think more about, like a professional career and what you might do afterwards? Was there a certain amount of strictness that was within the kitchen that was different than the prison strictness?
Yeah, you had to perform in that kitchen, or you got bounced. So it really, it did give me a discipline. It gave me something to actually look forward to, which when you're doing time, you need that because you got to manage your time. You know, thinking about getting out, I'm like, prison worked for me. I knew I never wanted to go back there. But when I got out, you know, I bounced from one job to the other. I did a lot of construction, and I wasn't good at anything. And then you know, kind of harkened back to what I was doing in the joint, and I always wanted to open up my own, you know, to open up a restaurant was pretty much the dream. And then me and my partners decided to, it wasn't a restaurant, but we decided to get in the food business by feeding bikers at these events.
Did you see a void in the marketplace at the event, or did you? Were you a bike rider and you thought, "I want to serve food," or did you go to these events and say, "Wow, there's no food here. This is a great opportunity"?
The second, yeah, I started. I got out in, I got out in 1981 March. By May, I had my first Harley, but I hung out with bikers on the inside, so it got that in my head, like, man, I gotta get. I didn't even know how to, I bought my first Harley before I even knew how to ride a motorcycle. And I learned on that. And then, so I started going to these bike events, and we did notice that, man, there was food, there was hamburgers, hot dogs, and, you know, things like that, but it was done by volunteers, and all the volunteers, they were not food people. So the food was awful at these. So I got the idea to go to the event coordinators and say, hey, let me do the food, let us do the food, and we'll whack you back 10%. And they were actually more than happy to do that because I don't think they were making any money on it. So that's how it started. And then I, you know, started doing that event. There was a lot to do in the biker world, from swap meets and club functions and things like that. And then once that started drying up, we started getting in the fair business. So then I started going up and down the East Coast, doing fairs and festivals.
Barbecue is not that easy, though. There's a lot of elements to barbecue that are significantly more complicated than throwing burgers or hot dogs on. Oh, you could have done, I don't know, Italian sausages. There's a lot of carnival fare that you could have.
Well, that's what I did, though.
That you could have, you know, done, right?
Right.
And so at first you were doing hamburgers, hot dogs, or?
No, we were doing sausage, peppers, and onions.
Okay.
And Delmonico ribeye steak sandwiches. So I always manned the Italian side of it. My partner did the charbroiling. And then but we called ourselves Dinosaur Barbecue because we were like, wow, all our competitors have like a marinara sauce. We're going to do a barbecue sauce. So that was our point of differentiation, was barbecue. So now we started heading into the South, and we're starting to get strange looks by people like, hey, why are you calling yourself barbecue? And I was like, man, we got the sauce, boom, boom, boom. And they were, no, this ain't barbecue. You know, barbecue is, and I remember a lot of people saying, you got to dig a hole in the ground. You got to do this. I was like, man, what are they talking about? And then I went to Memphis, and that was like the Shangri-La of barbecue for me. This was probably around 1985, 86. And I came back. I was like, man, we are changing everything. So gone was the sausage and peppers and steaks. And now we started doing what was probably pretty bad barbecue if I look back on it.
Well, you start with brisket and ribs or
no,
chicken?
No, brisket didn't come till later. It was chicken. We stayed with the sausage because, you know, I have a love of sausage. And then we got into ribs. So it was really chicken and ribs became the dinosaur's cornerstone. And then later came pork and brisket and all that stuff.
And when you were down in Memphis, was there something specific? Was it the whole city, or was there one place or one bite of food that you said, oh, a barbecue, I'm hooked, I gotta switch my whole, because it's actually kind of a pretty big pivot from sausage and peppers to ribs. There's not really a carryover there. They don't
no,
cross
zero,
so
zero. Both pork, but that's about it. Let's see, so I rode my motorcycle down, And I started hitting barbecue joint after barbecue joint. Some of it I was like, man, I just don't get it. It's okay. It wasn't blowing me away. Actually, there's three places that really influenced me is Payne's, the Cozy Corner, and Abe's Barbecue in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Those are the three ones that I went, God damn, that's what I'm talking about. It was that taste where, you know, where the smoke and the meat, everything came together. And then the light, then it was like, I got it. You know, I didn't have it, but I had the idea. And then it started the learning of the craft from that point.
At that point, what was more exciting to you? Was it the camaraderie? Was it getting better at cooking? Or was it the business? Was it generating income? What was exciting to you about those early days at the motorcycle meetups?
See, it was sometimes you'd make a lot of money. The next, if it rained or something bad happened, bad location, we'd lose it all. So, you know, I used to have my bank in my boot, my operating money in my right pocket, my personal money, my left pocket, and then we were heavily armed at that point. And that was the bank of everything right there on me. So it was staying alive and paying bills was the number one concern. And then when I discovered barbecue as a genre, I was like, oh my God, I became infatuated with it.
So was that a wild time? You're barbecuing all day, motorcycles all around, probably partying at night, going from city to city.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lawless land, to be honest. It sounds like it would be not the best place to be carrying around thousands of bucks worth of cash and a lot of equipment.
Right.
Did you have like a home-based commissary kitchen? Were you working out of an apartment? Like what?
No.
Where you just showed up with raw meat and just slapped barbecue sauce on it?
Yeah. So if you basically our life existed and we'd start to do swap meets in the spring, and then we'd hit the road, and you would just go from place to place. You would break down on Monday, show up the next day on a Tuesday, and most fairs and festivals started on Tuesday, Wednesday. So you tried to root yourself where it wasn't too long of a trip. And it was a very unhealthy lifestyle. It was a lot of partying and a lot of carrying on and really unsustainable for the long haul.
Well,
so that's why I got into the restaurant business.
You did it for 5 years. You were a young guy at that point. So
exactly.
The turnaround is easier when you're 21, 22. You can have a lot of fun until 4 a.m. and still wake up the next day. But at what point did a restaurant become a real viable option? And I'm curious if you started saving money while you were traveling around with the sole reason of opening up a restaurant, or did you go out and fundraise and not have any money saved?
Well, there wasn't a person in the world that was going to give us any money, so we knew we had what we made on the road is how we opened the restaurant. And a big event is my son was born, and I was really a terrible father. I was never around. That's when I decided I had to, you know, I had to get in a permanent place to raise this kid right. So that was like really one of the impetuses of opening a restaurant.
And did your family bring you back to Syracuse? Is that why that location? Because you had been traveling up and down the Eastern Seaboard. I'm sure you'd seen a lot of cities where you probably thought to yourself, maybe I could settle here. But you ended up coming back up to New York.
Syracuse was a home base.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how'd you find the location? It's a cool building for people that have never been there, that have never seen it. Can you describe it a little bit and how you found the property and what appealed to you about it?
Well, I had friends who owned a motorcycle shop that were above the restaurant. And there was this big ramp that, ironically, if your bike was broken down, you had to push it up this ramp.
Yeah, second floor repair shop sounds.
Right, but that was the first Cadillac dealer in Syracuse, and that ramp went back to, that's where they drove the Cadillacs up to fix it. Downstairs was an old shot and a beer joint that had been around for 50 years, and in the front room was the diner. So they had the old lady, it was called the N&H Tavern, and the old lady cooked the food in the diner, and the old man ran the bar. And I loved this place. I mean, any excuse to go to both of those, I did. But coincidentally, my friends had the bike shop upstairs. They were about 80 years old, and they were exhausted. Imagine, like, I'm going to be 60. as tired as you get now, I can't imagine them at 75, 80. But they wanted out, and I wanted in, and we worked it out.
And so you open up a barbecue restaurant. It's sort of a it's a bar as well, right? It's definitely a place that people can come and hang out.
There was no bar at first.
Oh, that was later on.
Yeah, I could not get a liquor license till we opened up in 88. I could not get a liquor license till almost 92. And then when I had, so we closed the bar down and just had this 900-foot restaurant in the front room.
And so what was the immediate, if there was one, reaction to this new barbecue restaurant in town? Did you have crickets, lines out the door? What were you hoping for and what was the reality?
Absolute crickets. It was awful. So coming from the road, you would, you know, you're in a fair and you got thousands of people, you know, foot traffic in front of you. We thought for some reason that was going to translate to us opening up a restaurant. And we opened up, because we started with breakfast, believe it or not. And we were open breakfast, lunch, dinner. And absolute crickets. It was awful. I wanted to shoot myself. And that went on for about a year. And then, you know, one plate of food at a time. And, you know, we did not look like your traditional restaurateurs at that time. And it was motorcycles out front. And it was just a different time back then. Bikers were looked at differently, you know, in the late 80s than they are now. I mean, your dentist is on a Harley now. It doesn't matter. But back then, it was a little different perception of things. And then once we got our liquor license, that's when things started turning around.
Did you have difficulty with not only the liquor license, but also other aspects of setting up the business based on that negative stereotype, that perception of the biker? You had, you know, long hair and tattoos, and you had come out of prison. Did did that make your life a lot more difficult beyond the restaurant just being a hard thing to open?
If it did, I didn't notice it. You know what I mean? That's not what I was, you know, that's not even what I thought about, to be honest with you. I was going out with a girl. She lived in Miami, and her, I was more thinking about, man, if this don't work, I'm going to move to Miami. Because it was like her father wanted me to work construction with him. I was like, damn, I can't. Man, I'll move to Miami. There's always that little light at the end of the tunnel that I stuck with. So no, I didn't think of that.
So you were able to get the liquor license. At that point, you did bring on two other partners, right?
Yep.
And they had a distribution business, right? They were involved in alcohol or food in some capacity, correct?
My partner Larry, just recently deceased. You know, rest in peace, Larry. He was a liquor salesman, and I knew Larry, my God, for years before that. But we lost touch for a while. He came in one night. I was mopping up the floor, closing down, and he came in, started looking around, like, "Hey, I heard this place is getting a liquor license." He goes, "John, is that you?" I was like, "Larry, what are you doing?" Boom. Next thing you know, we start talking. I was like, "Yeah, I want to open up the bar end and blah blah blah." He goes, "Do not talk to another person." I was like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah. Give me a week and I'll get back to you." And he did. And he came back and said, "I want to be your partner." And him and his wife at the time, Nancy, became our partners.
At the beginning, those first 1-2 years, you and your partner, are you doing everything? Are you doing the cooking? Are you doing the front of house? I'm curious about the barbecue smoking setup first off. And then also, what was your customer forward facing mentality like, you know, were you pushing for the rough around the edges, this is like a cool guy vibe, or were you bending over backwards, the customer's always right?
Number one, we wanted anybody and anyone to get in there to pay a bill, so we didn't it wasn't that well thought out. It was just it was like, you came in, I took your order, I cooked your food. I may ring you up, but I did bring out the food to you. And then after lunch run, so in the morning, I did all the, you know, we're in the smokehouse, we're, you know, doing whatever specials. Then in the afternoon, you get back into prep. Then you come back out to the line. And we had a routine at that time after lunch every day. We smoked a big fat joint after lunch to get right for the second turn. And it was all consuming. But there was, at no point did we say, you know, we're going to be this cool biker bar and we're going to have a certain attitude. We were just who we were. And yeah, once we got the booze, people put it together, because barbecue wasn't, you know, it wasn't a Northeastern thing. So people really didn't know what the heck this was. They knew ribs, of course, but what we were trying to do. And I'm going to say, I don't know if the barbecue was any good. So,
were you using half barrel smoke, like smokers? What exactly was your setup like? Were you using a specific type of wood? Were you just
I don't even know, to be
flying
honest,
by okay. the seat of your pants?
It was
a little bit.
Yeah, it was the 55 gallon drum, and then I'll never forget our first piece of like high tech equipment. We bought this thing called a smokerama. The smokerama was a circular pit that you hung the ribs, and you put wood chips in it, and it was just terrible. And then we graduated from there. We had the barrel, and then we got, God, years later, I think it was an old hickory, and that became our, you know, our pit at that, the most high tech pit that we had.
Was there a point, how many years in, that you really felt maybe a little comfortable, like, wow, things are really working, and they've been working for X amount of time. Mm. I'm not every week worried about if we're going to be able to keep the lights on. At what point was that? And did you then start thinking about what the next steps would be, or did you not really have a grand vision at that point yet?
There wasn't a grand vision. It really happened, you know, very organically. After 91, we started doing live music also. So Dr. Blue, Kelly James, came to me, blue singer, and said, hey, man, you know, go great with this barbecue is live music. I was like, man, I don't know nothing about putting on live music. He goes, don't you worry about it. I'll do everything. And it was every Thursday was Blue Thursday with Dr. Blue. And at that point, then it started like, damn, all right, it's starting to happen here. Then we started booking some more. And then I started booking national acts there. I mean, we had everyone from, oh, man, Jimmy Rogers, James Cotton, all the old school blues guys started coming through there. So then it became like a scene at nighttime because, you know, if you look at the trajectory of blues, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. We hit it right at the right time. So it was almost like barbecue, Harleys, and blues had a moment, and it all came together and created a, you know, a pretty good scene in Syracuse. So for those first couple of years after we got the, you know, I had to teach myself the bar. I didn't know how to run a bar. I never had waitresses before, so we had to learn the whole full service thing. So we were always playing catch up. Then I started making the barbecue sauce. People were like, hey, I want to buy sauce. So now I get into the sauce business. And I met these guys, Razorback Cookers out of Blytheville, Arkansas. And they said, you come down. We'll charge you by the hour. You make your own sauce. So now we start bottling. I'd fly into Memphis, rent a car, make my sauce, ship it. And I had a great time. That was, I love them guys, and I always had a good time in Memphis. Then it started popping a little bit, and it didn't make sense anymore to do that. So now we found a place in Rochester. So I started going to Rochester, and I looked at this beautiful old building, a 1905 train station. And it was empty, and it's been empty for years. I was like, what, you know, what is going on with that? Maybe we should put a dinosaur there. Because I'd get on and off and see it every once a week when I'd go to Rochester. So that was why we did the second one. It wasn't like, we're going to expand and do this. I fell in love with that piece of property. Beautiful old train station perched over the river. And that, of course, created its own set of problems because I didn't plan for what happens with two. Operating two restaurants is different than one restaurant. So,
what was the craziest part about that? It seems like at every step that you've had to add something on, mm-hmm. you just figure it out somehow. So yeah. I'm curious, the major challenge of that is quality control, mm-hmm. logistics, and oversight, right?
Yes.
You can't be in both places at the same time. Right. How did you at first tackle that? Did you hire a bunch of people? Did you get a manager that you trusted? What were the ways?
Yeah, we did. We hired a manager, and then I just was in Syracuse in the morning, Rochester at night, Rochester back to Syracuse. It was unsustainable again, living that type of lifestyle. And then, then I got some people, and yeah. Yeah.
Did it ever get to a point where you thought to yourself, when you had two, I'm talking mm-hmm. about, where you thought to yourself, I think that this is a big brand. Mm-hmm. Did you think this is something, you know, you've got the sauces mm-hmm. going. Clearly there's a scene at both mm-hmm. locations. Did you start to put together a business plan and take it out to anyone, or were you really just focusing on those two?
Just focusing on those two.
And so we'll talk more about how it expanded after the break, but mm-hmm. right before we take a break, I'm just curious, when you got these two locations, are the menus the same, and are you doing the same barbecue at both places, mm-hmm. or were there things that you had to change that were dictated by you being spread so thin in the location, or was mm-hmm. it exactly like a stamp of the
no, okay. No, it changed. I never wanted, like I never thought I could replicate Syracuse. Like that happened just so organically, and I didn't want it to be have that chain feel to it. So yeah, Rochester, the barbecue is the same, but the building looks so different, and the side dishes were a little different, and maybe a few appetizers were different. So that will always, you know, as even we went further with new locations down the road, that was the template. The restaurant's got to feel like its own place and not feel like Syracuse. I don't know if that was the best business move, but it was. It's what I felt at the time.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about Dinosaur Barbecue with John. Stick with us here on The Line.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. My guest today is John Stage, owner and founder of Dinosaur Barbecue with 8 locations across New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Before the break, we were talking about all the ways that you maybe you grew, but you didn't know exactly how to grow, and you were kind of making it up as you went along, but you were having great success. You had multiple locations. At a certain point in the 2000s, you get approached by a larger investor group. Mm-hmm. And this is when the Soros family approaches you and says, mm-hmm. you've got a great thing going. Mm-hmm. We'd like to get involved. Tell us a little bit about that. Was that a shock to you? Did you see something like that coming?
Well, we had a lot of people that approached us over the years, and I just was never ready for it. And then my two partners at that time were looking to exit the business. They, you know, they had been in it a while, and they were both 10 years older than me, and they were just like, you know, we're looking to get out of this somehow. And it was kind of a perfect opportunity at that point because, you know, I had no idea how we would perform some kind of exit like that. And that was one of the reasons that partnership came into being.
Would you consider yourself at that point, were you a very ambitious restaurateur? Were you a business person who was saying to yourself, I really want to grow and I want to go after, I don't even know if it was called, venture capital at that point? Now with the VC companies, I guess it was just...
No, private equity.
Private equity, yeah. Private equity. But were you, clearly people were knocking on the door, but did you consider yourself, all right, I'm a restaurateur, I'm gonna steer this ship into a multi-unit large business?
Well, it evolved into that. I had to start thinking about that because private equity is not going to give you money unless there is expansion. So I always like a good caper, I always like, you know, a good hustle or, you know, what's next. And this provided that opportunity, you know, for what's next. So that was around 2008. And then if you look at what happened in 2008, the world kind of melted down financially. So we grew very slow. And I'm good for about, and now, of course, we get an infrastructure together. So after we did New York, I decided, like, wow, I need a little more layer of leadership in here because I can't be running all over the place. So once, when Soros came into it, they provided, you know, they provided that infrastructure. They provide, they brought in a lot of good things initially. And we grew about one a year. That was the most I can handle. I am not, I cannot handle more than that. And that's where, you know, we came at a crossroads a few years later that they wanted to expand a lot more than what I was, I'm going to say capable, wanting to, willing to, and capable of, because I can do one. I'm pretty good at that, but I'm not good at three or four a year. So I stepped back in 2013 and brought in, I said, you know, if they're going to, if you guys want, you know, this type of expansion, you got to bring somebody else in. A, who knows how to do it. B, loves doing it because it's just not me. So I stepped back for a little bit, right? Probably around 2014, I guess it was. And I became more of an advisor than a day-to-day guy. So.
And so just rewinding back a little bit to that 2009-2010 timeframe, mm-hmm. everybody, pretty much everybody that has a restaurant business right now, in the back of their mind, mm-hmm. what they're thinking is, am I going to be able to craft a strong enough narrative and mm-hmm. P&L sheet mm-hmm. so that someone's going to come knocking on my door and give mm-hmm. me money? Mm-hmm. So that happened to you. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, looking back now, would you have made the same decision?
You know, at the time, yes, because it was, again, my partners wanted to get out, and I liked these guys. They were good dudes. So it wasn't any regret, really, until I pulled back. And then it became a weird situation of me being an older owner and founder and philosophically not on board with the growth trajectory. So that's when things got a little screwy.
In between 2010 and 2015, mm-hmm. seven restaurants open, mm-hmm. two of them, Chicago and Baltimore, obviously outside of the mm-hmm. sort of normal realm of right. your geographical locations, right. they close. Mm-hmm. It's your baby. It's mm-hmm. your namesake. You're attached to it. Mm-hmm. How did that feel to have those restaurants close? And were you in a position to really influence what was going on, or had you already at that point been sort of removed a little bit so that yeah. was it out of your control and out of your purview?
Well, you go through some funny things psychologically when you do step back. So if you look at Chicago, I didn't operate the restaurant. I was there maybe five times. So I didn't get the blood, sweat, and tears into it that would have been, you know, where I would have felt bad about it. It sucked. It always sucked. But it wasn't my baby at that point. So, and the same thing with Baltimore. I didn't run it. So I wasn't involved in it as I was before. So we never should have been in these places. So
now that you've had your businesses open for such a long time, and mm-hmm. you've gone through all the stages that a restaurateur mm-hmm. does, you've opened one, two units that are sort of privately owned. You've mm-hmm. gone the private equity route. You've mm-hmm. expanded to other cities. You've kind of done everything. You've mm-hmm. done CPG. So I'm wondering, you know, people that listen to this show, they're just getting started. Maybe mm-hmm. they have an idea for a concept in their head. Mm-hmm. What type of advice can you give to someone who thinks, I'm opening up a concept on a small budget mm-hmm. or a mid-level budget, and mm-hmm. they're hoping to attract capital? What if you were going to maybe invest in someone, mm-hmm. what would you tell them to do, and how would they put themselves in a good position to attract what happened to you?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Let me see. The restaurant business is so different now than, let's say, when I started it. You said the Wild West, and it really was back then. If you look at the economics of opening up, when I opened up in Harlem in 2003, 2004, I was paying $14 a foot. That same neighborhood is $150 a foot right now.
Yeah.
So to that young entrepreneur, are we in New York City? Are we in Syracuse? There's so much easier places to do business than New York right now. So you've to an investor, they really care about one thing. How are they going to get paid back? And how are they going to make money off this deal? So you have to, you really have to have your shit together more than, let's say, I did back then. Because I could freelance it. But if I was the same person with that second restaurant, I said, all right, I am going to open this restaurant. I never had a business plan. These things just happen. So you got to have an airtight business plan. Why do you want to exist? How can this space make money? And what is it in this so crowded restaurant world right now? Why are you different? And because there wasn't this many restaurants back then. I don't think there's ever been more restaurants than there are right now. So competition is harder. The operating environment is harder. The rents are harder. The government's harder. It's a tough business.
The advice is don't do it.
But you know, anyone that does ask me, I just talk about how hard it is, mm-hmm. and how are you going to overcome that? You know, why should you exist is really the question I ask.
But you couldn't stay away, because in 2018, you basically, correct me if this is the wrong way of saying it, but did you basically buy back your company? Is that fair? Like you became the majority owner of your company again. Walk us through that. How did you initiate that process? And why? I imagine that you went from having a less stressful life to throwing yourself back in the mix to a 900 person company.
Yeah.
So how did you do it, and why did you do it?
Well, you know, I got to thank the Soros guys once again. They made it really easy for me, and they wanted to get out of that space. So asked me if I was interested. I was interested, and I really was afraid of what would happen to the legacy of the business if it went to another private equity firm. I don't think that the people that have been with Dino for as long as they have would probably stick around for another private equity go around. It was made easy. They were great to work with on the end. And I just opened up a pizza place, a Pizza Regionale. It's across the street from the original Dinosaur during my time away from Dinosaur, and being back in the kitchen and starting a brand new concept kind of got my juices flowing again. And then when presented this with Dinosaur, I was like, man, it's not going to be a good legacy if I didn't do this. I'd like to, as you get into 30 years like I am right now, you start thinking about longevity and what that means and, how you want to see things in the past or for the future. So I kind of figured that if I didn't do this, I probably would move. So I wouldn't have to see, Dinos on a day-to-day basis. So and there's so many great people that work for me and with me at Dino. I want to see them take it over and take it over to the next.
So tell me about what it was like to look internally at the brand you created with sort of a fresh pair of eyes. You've been removed for a minute,
right?
And then you step back in, it's yours, but it's different. Right. So what was that like to get your hands dirty again? Did you uncover things that were there happy surprises, and were there things that really pissed you off and that you said, oh my God, I got to fix this like today?
Well, I pretty much knew what I was going to get into.
Okay.
I found that we became very inconsistent, and you could go to one and get something great over there, maybe not as great. I just found a lot of inconsistency and a very fractured team at this point. So the first thing we did was we took and moved everything back to Syracuse. And I'm almost like chief consistency officer right now. I'm back in the kitchen. I'm reworking recipes. Whatever's good, I want to make it great. If it sucks, get rid of it or make it great. There's no middle ground right now. We just want to make everything great. And being back in the kitchen and messing around with all the recipes and updating them, I love doing that. That's my sweet spot. And then I got a great team around me, so it makes it easier. So, yeah, there's a ton of challenges, but I'm having fun again.
Do you have someone who acts as a director of logistics or a chief officer or something along those lines? Is that the structure that you have?
Yeah, I have a you call him a COO. He reports to me, but he's doing the logistics. He's the thread between all the restaurants right now. And then each area directors like Garth will have Harlem and Brooklyn or Newark. So there's people that have a piece of the, you know, 2 to 3 restaurants. And that's how we're rebuilding this, is getting people. I want owners operating the restaurants. I want people that have a stake in it, operating it. And that's what we're doing and in the process of doing right now.
Yeah, speak to that a little bit. There are a couple people that have been with you for a while, and you've been able to convert them into having some of ownership of their locations, right?
Yes.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that comes with the luxury of having many locations and being able to do that, but not everybody does that.
Right.
So that decision, speak a little bit about it. Was it done purely from a loyalty perspective? They've been with you for a long time. What are the advantages to doing that?
Well, the advantage is a little more of a peace of mind thing. And, you know, I hate to sound like an old guy, but, you know, you start thinking when you're 60 in the restaurant business still, you do look at the future of like, I want them to. So it's good for me and it's good for them. Financially, it can make a big difference in their life. And for me, I'm around people I want to be around. And so I don't know if it's not like I'm just giving it to them for their loyalty. I'm giving it to, that's part of it, but they're great operators. And I want to see them take Dino into the next decades.
As you look forward about your future legacy and how that may grow and what may shape it, what are your thoughts that you can share on how Dinosaur can reemerge under your leadership again and grow, change? What does that look like?
Well, I really don't care about growing right now. It's a matter of fact, it's the last thing I want to do. I don't even mind getting smaller. I just want to run great restaurants. That's all I care about right now. And when we got into a growth period, what happens is it's always the next thing. And therefore, you're putting all your energies to what's next. I got 9 restaurants with the Italian restaurant. And that is enough for me right now. Like, I got enough. And I don't care if we even get smaller. I don't care. I like the idea of it. So we can be great. I don't want to do this just to open restaurants anymore. I already did that. It wasn't for me.
By restaurant standards, you have just 30 years. It's just an incredibly long time. And you've basically gone, you started before really the internet and Instagram and Yelp were a thing, and you have weathered that storm somewhat.
Yes.
Do you find that as a whole, the changing of technology has helped the businesses, or is it to the detriment of your restaurants?
You know, it's definitely different. So, you know, the old days used to get reviewed once, 2, 3, depending on the amount of publications. Now you get reviewed every day. So you have to monitor that. You have to engage on Instagram and your Facebook page. And these are not my strong points. So I have a nice group of young people that are very good at that. So we don't spend, you know, money on advertising, but we now focus more on, the social media aspect of the business. But if you relied on me doing that, it just wouldn't go anywhere. So they do it, and they do a good job on it. And I'm very happy to turn that over. The other thing, you know, technology is the Grubhub and the DoorDash has changed the business dramatically. You know, where your dining room may be flat, our big growth is food to go. And unfortunately, that comes at a price, you know, a 20, 25% whack on your margin on that. But that is what hasn't been great about technology. I think it's good for the consumer because nobody wants to call up restaurants anymore. And, you know, that was not great. Get somebody on a busy Saturday night and they're not listening to you properly. So the technology of that is great, but it's finding how to make that profitable. And that's a big challenge.
Yeah, that's not only is that a huge challenge for literally any restaurant across the board, but you deal in meat, which mm-hmm. is not getting cheaper as time right. goes on. And I assume that with many locations, you've got some vertical integration and you've been able to find some efficiencies there. Right. But how do you, as a big brand, how do you weather the fact that in New York, I'm sure it's a bigger problem than in some of your other locations, yep. but in New York specifically, you see restaurants that are shifting now 60, 70, 80% of their business is delivery only.
Right.
Are you just kind of rolling with it and figuring it out? Like, what are your strategies for dealing with that?
Well, we had to change parts of our, it was more of a to-go thing. And it, you look, again, looking at your packaging, looking at your efficiencies, try to figure out and negotiate better rates because it's not going back. It's not going backwards.
Right.
It's never going to be what it is. And I just can't walk away from it. So it's constant trying to get better at it and to become more efficient. And when you have 8 restaurants, you don't turn on a dime as quick. You know, like if I had 1 or 2 restaurants, okay, here's what we're going to do. Now, if you do something, now you got to make sure all 8 are doing it. And that slows you down a little bit. But it's here to stay, and it's figuring out how to make it profitable and managing the people that deliver your food. You could plate that up. It could be perfect. But now it travels with somebody else, and things happen along the way.
Now that you've regained control, it's you're about 2 years back in the mix, I would say.
1 year.
1 year back in the mix. What has been a great surprise now that you've fully kind of jumped back into Dinosaur? Mm-hmm. And what's been something that's been just a gigantic headache that's been extremely difficult for you since you've gotten back in the mix?
Oh, man. You know, I'm not sure there's one. I'm not sure they go high and low. It's a mix of little surprises up and down. There's really no one, oh my God, this is great, and oh my God, this is terrible. The labor market's different also. I'm going to say if what's challenging is the labor market. That's probably your biggest challenge right now. And government mandates, big problem. So you're operating, if you had a 10% bottom line, you've now got a 5% bottom line through no fault of your own, just the environment of the business. So it's that's the most challenging. That is that I'm going to say government mandates and the tight labor market right now are two very tough.
And what's been the thing that's just been like a real pleasant surprise now that you're back, like managing the thing that you created?
Well, we switched over to prime brisket, and it's falling back in love with that process of barbecue. And I still look at that and like, that's good. When I can say that's good barbecue, that's a win for that day. So it's really when I feel really proud about that food. And I love the way the brisket is. And that's what makes me very happy. So that would, and continual improvement of, you know, our food and our team, and you know, there's no one magic wand. It's a day-to-day grind of trying to make things better. But we're, you know, it feels pretty good, and I think that's what gets me up in the morning.
Still 30 years in, tweaking, making changes.
Oh man,
still searching for the perfect meat and the perfect day and the perfect dining experience.
Yeah.
You've got too many locations to list them all, but why don't you tell everyone who's listening what's the address of the one in Harlem, what's the address of the one in Syracuse, and obviously they can find you online and find all the locations.
Yeah, www.dinobbq.com will get you every location. The one in Syracuse on the corner of Willow and Franklin downtown. 12th Avenue and 125th Street in Harlem, and Brooklyn is 4th Avenue in Union.
John, thanks so much for being here and sharing some of your story about all the dinosaur barbecues. Congratulations on 30 years in Syracuse,
all right.
15 years in Harlem.
20 in Rochester.
Unbelievable. Everyone, go check out one of those locations whenever you're nearby. There's a lot in the New York, Connecticut, New Jersey metropolitan areas. John, thanks again. Everybody, thanks for listening. Join us every Tuesday for new episodes of The Line here on Heritage Radio. The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.